Today feels like a good day for a story about librarians who saved the world. From SDPB, it's Friday, February 14th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Book and Dagger. It's the true story of librarian spies who stepped up in World War II when their country needed them. We'll talk with the author about secret training camps, detailed cover stories, and the search for information that defined spycraft for the future. Dakota Life heads to Gerritsen. We'll bring you a bittersweet love story for Valentine's Day. In their own words, we'll hear debate from Peer about funding for the state library. Plus, our local librarians choose books for the In the Moment producers. Find out what we're reading this weekend. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. We come in with laughter. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh and Jackie Hendry, my Galentine Day. The annual Galentine's pitch break is here. Hey, friend, how are you?
It's the best day of the year.
I got you a present. It's a Hershey's Kiss with Snoopy on it because I know how much you love Snoopy and Woodstock, and I also know how much you love SDPB.
These are the main things that people know about me.
There's some Star Wars stuff in there. We have our heart-shaped Valentine's glasses on. We are in the studio, and we are talking about SDPB's Valentine's Day drive because our love language here at SDPB is acts of service. My love language is words of affirmation, by the way. Do you know your love language?
I think mine is quality time.
Oh, see, all of these things we will give you through SDPB.
That's why I keep the radio on all day long, because it's quality time with all of my favorite voices in South Dakota.
Showering words of affirmation your way all the time. So we show that love every day through our ability to cover 98% of the state on television and on radio, and that means you are always up to date. Especially we have that radio on all day long with weather, with emergency alerts, with In the Moment, with Jackie Hendry, with Lee Sturbinger in the news, with CJ Keene in the news, with Crystal Mija. All of the SDPB folks show up for you all day throughout the day. So we are asking you to share some love with a Valentine's Day donation. Go to sdpb.org or call or text GIVE to 605-443-6963. And we say thank you for being our Valentine or our Galentine, as the case may be.
And a special shout out to our Valentine donors, Milt and Chris Carter. They've challenged SDPB listeners and viewers to a $50,000 sustainer match. What does that mean? I'm so glad you asked. Any sustainer action will raise $100 for SDPB. Not a current member or sustainer? Well, now's your chance. Join the club, sign up, give a monthly gift, and that gets an additional $100 for SDPB. Well, don't feel left out if you're already part of the sustainer club. You can still increase your monthly gift and still get an additional $100 for SDPB. It's that simple.
Or you can do this other thing, which I just found out, which is if you're a sustaining member and you're putting that sustaining membership donation on your credit card, you can change it to your EFT checking account. And that is considered a sustaining member action. And I have done this action, and it is very easy to do.
Breaking news.
And then that is also a sustaining action. So we just want to take some sustaining action
here. Sustaining action. You can do that today. SDPB.org or call or text GIVE to 605-443-6963 and keep SDPB reliable and independent and consistent and giving you all of the love languages.
And free. All right. Coming up this hour In the Moment, we're going to have, listen to this, Jackie, Blind Date with a Book.
Ugh.
A story about an author who wrote a book about librarians who saved the world during World War II. True story.
Oh, yes.
A bittersweet love story from Gerritsen, South Dakota, from SDPB's Dakota Life. Greetings from Gerritsen. Mm-hmm. And some debate from the State House, in their own words, about state library services, where legislators make it clear that they are not interested in cutting state library funds, even though it's not a done deal, and those decisions will still be made, but we get to hear a little bit of that debate, too. So this is a power hour of libraries, books,
You just listed all my favorite things. We're talking about libraries. We're talking about books. We're talking about history. We're talking about South Dakota. We're talking about public policy. There you go.
It's all in 1 hour of In the Moment. And you were just telling me in the studio what's coming up on South Dakota Focus, and that is exciting too. So tell us a little bit about that as we talk about why we love our jobs.
Yes, I'm so excited. I've had the opportunity to meet so many fun and interesting people. The next episode of South Dakota Focus, February 27th, we get to meet some of those great faces that make these great places so fun to visit. We're meeting an award-winning hospitality worker here at the hotel on Phillips in Sioux Falls. We're meeting a husband and wife team that jumped into the tourism business right at the beginning of the pandemic and made it through out in Hot Springs and Hill City. And we also get to meet a Rapid City-based artist who I saw his work at the tourism conference and I was like, yes, I want to know everything about this. And he is taking his passion for the vast landscapes that we all love of South Dakota and finding a way to make those little travel size, something you can put in your bag when you go back home. So I'm really excited about this show featuring some of the local folks that make this industry what it is.
All right. So you can return the love, because while you're taking the 2 minutes out of your day that will take you to donate or take that sustaining action to increase your donation or switch it to your checking account from your credit card withdrawal, while you're taking that donating action, that sustaining action, Jackie Hendry is back working on that script for Focus, and I'm here interviewing somebody for the next show, and the producers are hard at work, and the managers and the engineers. We love South Dakota. We love SDPB. We love you, our listeners, who are supporting us during this time. Return the love, share the love, sdpb.org, or call or text GIVE to 605-443-6963. And thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we have a Valentine's Day tradition here at In the Moment. The producers and I participate in our local library's Blind Date with the Book program. Here's how it works. The library provides an online form where readers answer questions about books they've read and enjoyed recently, followed by questions about our other literary interests. Then the librarians select a new book, ebook, or audiobook for each reader and place those books on hold under your library card. In the Moment, producers Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester and I are now gathered in SDPB's Kirby Family Studios to reveal what the librarians have chosen for us this year. Ari, Ellen, hey guys, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
We've all been running. I sound so tired. That was the most tired high. They're working hard to bring you a daily radio show. Okay. Blind Date with the Book is one of my favorite times of the year because, of course, I love libraries. Who would like to reveal, let's start with Ellen, what the librarians have chosen for you this year?
They chose Biography of X by Catherine Lacey. Mm. I was very interested by this book because I gave them a mix of fiction and nonfiction books as my previous read that I've loved.
Uh-huh.
And the first year we did this, they gave me a nonfiction book, the second year fiction, and I was very curious what they were going to do for this year.
Yeah.
And they basically did both with a fiction book that is pretending to be nonfiction.
Have you heard of it and have you already read it?
No, I had not even heard of it. I had not read it.
That's always a big win because Ellen reads quickly and extensively. So finding a book that she has not read is a prize in and of itself.
Yes.
What did they say they picked for you and why? Because it comes, I don't know, for our library, they put a little note in there and they write a little something wonderful on the book to us.
Yeah, they chose it for me because I enjoy historical and diverse reads.
There we go.
Yep. So it has a little bit about World War II in there, which I know later in the show we'll be getting into.
Yes.
And then also it's very queer and I love that.
Excellent. So will you spend this weekend reading this book, do you think?
I think I will.
Are you? It will be on the stack at least because we have. Ari Youngeman, what did they pick for you?
I got The Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard by Michael Callahan.
And what is this?
This is a romantic mystery, which is right up my alley because that is exactly what I described as wanting. And they said, I chose this book for you because you enjoy mysteries and romantic reads. Callahan's novel is unique in that it alternates between the past and present, unraveling family secrets with this parallel narrative. This story is fast-paced, suspenseful, and unputdownable.
There we go. Now, did you get an ebook or an audiobook or a hard...
This will be a hardcover.
This will be a hardcover book. Okay. Because you can request any format. Although, yes. I've not done that because I do like to hold my books in my hand.
I'm almost always. But. I'm generally an ebook girl. I love the Libby app and I use it every single day. So I'm actually excited to have a hard copy in my lap again.
Awesome. All right. They chose for me The Origin of Others by the great Toni Morrison. And I could not be more delighted with this. It is a small, slim little trim size here. I'll be able to read it over the weekend. It's a collection of essays that come from some speeches, I believe. And who would not want to spend a weekend in February soaked in the language of the great Toni Morrison? So thank you very much to Jade at the library for picking my book this year, A+.
Have you read any Toni Morrison before?
I have read some Toni Morrison before, but I have not read all of Toni Morrison by any measure, so it's a wonderful thing to keep going. So check out your local library. They probably have a blind date with a book either on a computer or if you walk down into the library itself, they'll usually have some kind of display for Valentine's Day. Find the love that you need. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Throughout the hour today, we are sharing some love with libraries and librarians this Valentine's Day. And what better way to do that than to share the story of how American librarians saved the world? I first heard scholar Elise Graham talk with Brooke Gladstone on the podcast On the Media. As soon as I heard her talk about her 2024 book, Book and Dagger, I raced to find a copy, and I am delighted to bring a conversation with the author to you today. We'll begin with the fact that America didn't know what it was doing regarding spycraft during the World War II era.
At the beginning of World War II, the U.S. didn't have a standing spy agency. So the head of the OSS, which was the wartime predecessor to the CIA, William Donovan, decided that he needed to get experts in every field as quickly as he could. And he decided the best way to do that was to recruit as spies and intelligence agents as many librarians and professors as he could.
Why librarians and archivists and professors? What was his thought process there?
Well, for one thing, he needed expertise in every subject in the library. He needed to know about mapping. He needed to know about geography. He needed to know about certain areas of the world. He needed to understand how to read whatever texts were available front and back and sideways. And the best way to get expertise on every subject in the library is to just raid the library for recruits. So people were getting calls in the library, or government agents would stop by your classroom while you were teaching, or you would be recruited during a college football game when nobody would notice another alumni-looking guy in a suit walking around campus. These guys were pulled out of their library carrels and thrown into dangerous wartime situations.
And some of them were ready for that. What kind of people were recruited, and what sort of information did you find about their mental preparation to take on that kind? We'll get to their training in a minute, but just, were they inclined to be adventurous people?
Some of them were very much. Some of them had been, knowingly or not, waiting for that phone call all their life. I mean, listen, in movies, spies are sort of ripped hunks who carry lots of gadgets. But in real life, a weapon would blow somebody's cover. The best way to be a spy is to be the sort of person who's easily overlooked. And these spies, librarians and professors, were chosen precisely because they would be overlooked. But that didn't mean they weren't good detectives. And that didn't mean they didn't have exactly what it took in terms of fortitude and ingenuity to be excellent undercover agents. So one of these historical figures was Adele Kyber. She got her PhD in classics at the University of Chicago. And then because women had a hard time becoming professors in those days, she built herself a career traveling around Europe and taking photographs of hard-to-find texts in different libraries. That meant that she became an expert in tracking down hard-to-find texts and also in doing all of the kind of personal working of people that you need to do in order to get access to things you might not otherwise get access to. She was contacted by the OSS and asked whether she would like to put her talents toward becoming an undercover agent who found documents for the OSS in wartime Stockholm.
Yeah. And they are going to ask her to find some far-flung documents and texts. How much pressure did they put on her to find ways to come up with rare books and pamphlets and papers?
Well, she found all kinds of documents that she really shouldn't have gotten access to. She was able to get underground newspapers. She was able to get books that the Germans had designated as secret books and taken off of the shelves. She was able to get industry directories. She was able to get scientific journals that were no longer sent to the United States, some of which were sent to the library at a little place in New Mexico called Los Alamos. She was the most productive documents acquisition agent of the war. She was able to acquire a tremendous amount of material, a lot of which she acquired by making friends with not just with people in the underground, for instance, but with Germans or people who were allied with Germans. Yeah. She seemed to present to everyone she met a reflection of what they wanted to see. Hmm. She also seemed to have been waiting her whole life to be able to use her talents in a way that was this intensive and this consequential.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit and talk about, you mentioned recruiting. What are some of the ways that people were approached and recruited to become spies for the Allies?
Sometimes they were, as I said, called in their libraries or visited in their classrooms. And if they said yes to the recruitment, then they were sent to training camps. Some Americans went to training camps in Britain. The training camps in Britain, which has a sort of older and more established intelligence agencies, were often very posh. They would be in these country manors and have housemasters and servants and that sort of thing. Now, the Americans, their training camps were, they were muddy camps with tents in national parks, which had enough privacy to keep the goings on secret. You'd learn how to fight in a way that would leave the other person not just injured, but dead. But you would be learning how to do it with the materials that were at hand. So women were taught how to use a makeup compact as a sort of knuckle duster. You were taught how to fold a newspaper so that it could become a deadly weapon. You were taught how to disarm somebody else using a matchbox. So the idea in a lot of spycraft is that you couldn't have a weapon and a cover story if you went undercover, because if you were caught up by the Gestapo, then you couldn't really say you were an innocent person and you had a weapon which an innocent person wouldn't be carrying. So you would be trained in how to use the ordinary materials that were within arm's reach in order to disable or kill your opponent.
Yeah, and every single thing that you have on you, from the clothes on your back to the tobacco scraps in your pocket, mattered. How
everything could be of use.
Yeah. How detailed were they in creating these cover stories?
They were incredibly detailed. By the time you were going out into the field, if you had grains of tobacco in your pocket, it should be tobacco that's manufactured in the place that you're going to. If you have scraps of paper in your pocket, something that spies call pocket litter, each one of those scraps of paper should have a story in it. Nothing isn't accounted for. And you should also have with you two cover stories wherever you go, one being a completely innocent cover story, like, I don't know, sorry, officer, I'm a nun returning from Vespers, and another one being a cover story that an innocent person would make up if they were guilty of something other than being a spy. So, okay, officer, you caught me. I'm a nun, but I'm not returning from Vespers. I'm having an affair with one of our congregants, and I'm returning from his apartment. You know, if you were caught and if you were subjected to torture, you were expected to keep quiet for, I think the number is 36 hours, not because you were going to be rescued. You weren't going to be rescued, but because after you failed to check in, that would be the amount of time it took for all of your contacts to go to ground. Mm. it was incredibly dangerous, and a lot of people died behind enemy lines.
You mentioned in the book even the people who are working radio operators are high fatality rate for those.
That's right. In the training camps, they were considered to be dead men walking. Some of the students encouraged each other not to look the people training as radio operators in the face because they were going to get caught within about 6 months. And nobody wanted the radio operators when they were caught to remember their faces.
Yeah. In this training area, there's this, nobody's getting to know each other because if you're caught, you don't want to reveal that you saw somebody back in training. That's lonely. It's a lonely and terrifying existence in some ways.
It is. Being a spy is a lonely and terrifying existence. People did make friends with each other in the training camps, but they didn't know each other's real names.
Okay.
They had cover names, and sometimes they would try to get each other to give away their covers. I think it would be a very interesting situation, frankly, to be friends with someone and you had no idea what their background was, and you were trying to use detective methods to find out. But by the time you went into the field, that was a very lonely way to be, partly because you were sometimes asked to solve problems in ways that would put yourself or other people in danger. And you couldn't really call your boss and ask what's the moral thing to do. You're out there on your own. There was an instance where some Norwegian resistance members had to bomb a ferry in order to stop the Germans from getting the last sort of remaining supply of heavy water that was in Norway. Heavy water is an ingredient to make an atomic bomb. So two of the people who were assigned to bomb the ferry, one of them, his friend was going to be on the ferry in the morning, and the other one, his mother was going to be on the ferry in the morning. So they had to ask themselves, do I tell my friend, do I tell my mother not to get on the ferry or not? If they did, then that person might tell their best friend, who might tell their best friend, and so on until everybody knows about it and the Germans have the capability to make a world-destroying weapon. Or do you say nothing, carry out your mission, and allow the people close to you to get hurt or killed? In the end, the person whose friend was going to be on the ferry didn't tell his friend, and the person whose mother was going to be on the ferry visited his mother and drugged her food so that she wasn't able to get on the ferry, but she also wasn't able to tell anybody else. But my point, I guess, is that I think it must be incredibly lonely to have to make those kinds of decisions completely on your own. And I suppose that ultimately the biggest decision that you make is to become a spy in the first place, knowing that sometimes things will be asked of you that you would never do under ordinary circumstances, but that are demanded of you by the occasion.
How much of what these people understood about spycraft was from fiction, and how much of it was from learning from experienced espionage agents?
Well, the people who were training the spies, a lot of the time, I mean, the U.S. had no standing spy agency at the beginning of World War II. So the people who were recruiting the spies and getting them in the training camps and so forth, sometimes all that they had as a source for their own knowledge of spies was spy fiction. So a lot of people were recruited in ways that would seem right out of a spy novel. One guy, Joseph Curtis, he was a literature professor at Yale. One of the senior faculty members visited him in his apartment at Yale and said, listen, you have to go to the Yale Club tomorrow. You need to wear a purple tie. You will see a man who is smoking a cigarette. He will see you and then put that cigarette out. He has a message for you, which is right out of a spy novel, pretty much, because I think that's where they got some of their ideas about how espionage is done. Then after Curtis agrees to go and train to become an undercover agent, he's told to go to the Baltimore train station and he'll see a man who's wearing a red carnation and to follow him and so on and so forth. And some of these guys used spy fiction either by reading books or watching movies or whatever to give themselves courage or give themselves a sense of, I guess, what an American fighting the Gestapo is supposed to be like. There was someone, he wasn't a professor or a librarian, but he's a very charming person, Varian Fry, who was a young man who went to Marseille and helped to rescue refugees there. And his entire training for doing this, his entire training for running what turned out to be an incredibly successful and important human smuggling operation conducted under the noses of the Gestapo, was that he watched a bunch of movies starring Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney, and then he went to occupied France, and he just acted like the heroes in those films. He even talked out of the side of his mouth like Humphrey Bogart. It's one of the most American things that I could imagine, to watch a bunch of movies and then go off to fight the Nazis with only the example of James Cagney, and then to do it, you know, on just the strength of your reckless generosity and courage and goodwill. But he pulled it off.
One of the things that you do so incredibly well, you obviously it's meticulously researched as a book, but also in the moments where you tell us, you know, we're going to invent a scene here, we're going to try, you know, this might have been some dialogue or invented dialogue to bring these characters to life. You're really good at writing spy dialogue. And I'm wondering if you enjoyed that part of it, because much of this is grim, but also the way that you portray it is page-turning and delightful, like a good spy novel.
Thank you very much. There are a few scenes of invented dialogue, as you say, always very clearly marked, and about four of them in 400 pages, so I hope not too much. I really enjoyed writing it, to be perfectly honest. When people were witty, I tried to make them witty in the way that people would be in the 1940s. So a black and white movie vibe. I get the impression that a lot of people who were spies during World War II enjoyed themselves. For some of them, like women agents, the war, although the stakes were impossibly high and the threats that they faced were incredibly grim, also had an amount of responsibility and freedom that they would never have been allowed otherwise. And also, they really were able to make use of talents that, you know, librarians had been training all of their lives to do the work of intelligence. It's just that even the people in intelligence, until they recruited those librarians, didn't know it. Their techniques, their methods proved to be so successful that it changed the way that we conduct modern spycraft. Modern espionage is based on the work that those agents did during World War II. They had been training all of their life for this incredibly high stakes, not just bibliographic detective work, but work in the kind of subterfuge and eliciting of information and occasional backstabbing that I think would be very familiar to people who are trained in library sciences or in academia. Yeah. I think that some of them did enjoy themselves, and I don't think that that's wrong of them.
Yeah. They had meaning and purpose, and it's not an exaggeration to say that these people did things that helped win the war or save the world from Nazism. That's not hyperbole.
No, not in the least bit. Their methods were so successful that, the war was fought on battlefields, but it was won in libraries. Their work was so successful that it changed the way that we do modern intelligence. The methods of the CIA are still based on the framework that they laid down. And rumor has it that to this day, the CIA does recruiting at the annual American Library Association conference. I can't say whether that's definitely true, but I went to the conference last year and the CIA was there. So I think that, I think that the lessons of that fight were learned by the intelligence establishment and haven't been forgotten since.
There's a lot that speaks in this book, Book and Dagger, I think also about misinformation and misdirecting from the rumor factory and the whisper campaigns to going back to what you mentioned about Los Alamos, the story that is told about the bomb. There's a lot of lessons for today in this book about using information to tell a narrative that you want to stick.
That's right. Information isn't just a resource. It's a weapon, particularly if you deploy it in the form of misinformation. So, for example, rumors were spread by a special branch of the intelligence services called whisperers, and their head was called the Master Whisperer, which is kind of amazing. And the book explains the rules for whispering, which can only be done by specialized whisperers. And I have to say, the lessons of how to do whispering, I think they're still relevant in the age of social media. One of the rules is, it's not your job as a whisperer to spread rumors. It's to get other people to spread rumors. And people will spread rumors that they find interesting more than they will spread rumors that they find true or likely to be true. So you've got to make sure that what you have to say is always interesting. So there are entire books that bring together all of the whispers that were sent out by the Allies during World War II, but often they had to do with things like wolves on the Russian front, because people like to talk about wolves, whether or not they think there are necessarily wolves there. During the lead up to the Normandy invasion, there was a tremendous amount of work done all across the Allied services to try to persuade the Nazis that whenever D-Day arrived, whenever the Allies struck at continental Europe, it wouldn't be in France, it would be in Norway. Luckily, Hitler had read a book written by someone after World War I that said that the Germans lost World War I because they weren't able to sort of capture and hold Norway. So he was absolutely obsessed with holding on to Norway, which meant that what the Allies were trying to do was to confirm what he believed already, which is a lot easier to do than to persuade someone of something new. Hollywood got involved. There was a deception training camp outside of Los Angeles that might as well have been a studio lot. It had actors, it had stagehands, it had people who were experts in making certain colors show up on black and white film. I mean, as specific shades of gray, because when the Allies used camouflage to disguise their tanks or to make it look like there were tanks where there weren't, they weren't trying to fool human eyes. They were trying to fool the cameras of the surveillance planes that were flying overhead, which meant that you needed to have a strong understanding of how different colors would show up on black and white film. Anyway, so there were whole armies of actors and other Hollywood types that were sent out to imitate the actual, you know, Allied forces, but to sort of collect in places that made it look like they were about to launch a campaign on Norway, which meant that Hitler wasted a lot of his resources putting as many people in Norway as he possibly could. But the most amazing thing is that this Hollywood corps managed to persuade Hitler, while the Normandy invasion was taking place, that it wasn't taking place. They managed to convince him after D-Day had arrived that this was actually just a distraction. That they intended to pull his forces to France so that they could actually attack Norway, which meant that he kept his forces in Norway instead of bringing them down to France. It was incredibly successful, and it's a demonstration of the power of storytelling when well wielded. You know, to the idea that a ghost army, a fictional army, would be able to defeat a real army on this scale is remarkable. But it also tells us about the remarkable power of storytelling.
Yeah. Elise Graham is the author of Book and Dagger, How Scholars and Librarians Became the Unlikely Spies of World War II. It's available now. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's Dakota Life heads to Gerritsen. The latest episode features the dramatic history of bank robberies and daring escapes, the astonishing beauty of the Palisades, love and fine art, and even a little goat yoga. Greetings from Gerritsen is available now on the PBS app. We are bringing you an excerpt from the show today. It is a bittersweet love story. In honor of Valentine's Day, Gerritsen's Rich Hosepfel met the love of his life in unusual circumstances. It was a whirlwind romance that endured.
Grew up in Gerritsen here, went to Gerritsen High School, graduated from Gerritsen High School. Then I went to Alaska, went to work on the Alaska Railroad there. It was a good job. I enjoyed it a lot. I raised a family up there, and I worked there for 35 years and retired in 2008 and moved back here. Well, my grandson was 4, so it would be like 2016. He started watching Thomas the Train. He says, "Grandpa, we should have a train."
After pulling his model trains from storage, Rich and his grandson started building what eventually turned into a recreation of Gerritsen that's in the museum today.
I've got all the landmarks around and pretty much everything in my memory from, say, a 10-year-old kid in early to mid-1960s when Gerritsen was a hopping place. It had 3 grocery stores, 2 hardware stores. We had 2 car dealerships, 2 implement dealers. everybody came to town on Saturday to shop at the grocery stores, and if you didn't come early, you'd have a hard time finding a parking place on the street. It was a great place to grow up. Wish she would have gotten to see this, but she never did. I wanted to do this for her because when we first met, I came back from Alaska on vacation for the first time in 1976. I'd gone up there in 73. And while I was back here, it was spring. My grandpa still had a farm, and my uncle did, and I went to help them with some planting. My grandpa was in his late 70s, I guess. Anyway, I was shoveling seed into the broadcaster for oats, and my uncle says, "I haven't seen Charlie come up over that hill for quite a while." We stopped what we were doing, and we ran over the hill, and the disc was all tangled up in a fence. And to make a long story short, he had had a heart attack and called the ambulance. My grandma had never driven, so they just didn't do that back then. They didn't learn how to drive. So I was the one on vacation, so I could drive grandma to the hospital every day. And it was McKinnon Hospital at that time. This beautiful girl was working as a ward clerk, and we hit it off. That was where I met my wife. And I was only here for a few days, and so we had to cram a whole bunch into just a couple, 3 days. And so I brought her out to Gerritsen. She was lived in Sioux Falls. She'd never really been out of town that much. Anyway, I brought her out here and took her to the Palisades, took her to Split Rock Park. And anyway, as soon as we came over the hills out there coming into town, she says, "This is Matt Dillon country." And I've always remembered that. And it gets me every time. So we had 3 dates, and I had to go back to Alaska. And I don't know, fate, whatever. Something happened, not to the airplane here, but where my connection was going to be. And they said that I could either stay an extra day here or I could fly to Seattle and spend the night there. I go, well, I'll stay here because my parents had taken me to the airport to drop me off. So I come back. I said, I can't fly today. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, well, take me to Corey's house. So they took me there, and she was crying, I was crying. And anyway, before that day was over and I went back to Alaska, I asked her to marry me, and after 3 dates, she said yes. And then that was in May. In October, I came back and we got married, and we had 45 years together. And anyway.
So are you saying that the town of Gerritsen and the beauty of this place helped seal the deal?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she loved it out here.
Dakota Life's Greetings from Gerritsen is available now on the PBS app. In Pierre, legislators are struggling with a tight budget and competing priorities. Recently, they had their say about one area they don't want to see cut: state library services. Before leaving the state, former Governor Kristi Noem recommended a slash to state library funding. The South Dakota Department of Education brought a bill that would change the responsibilities of the state library to match the proposed budget cuts. On February 5th, the House Education Committee heard testimony on House Bill 1041. Here are edited highlights from that testimony in their own words.
House Bill 1041 is our first bill, and this is to revise and repeal certain provisions pertaining to the State Library and the State Library Board.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Sarah Jones-Luter, and I'm the Library Director at the Redfield Carnegie Library, and I am representing myself today. I'm sure after me you'll hear testimony about specific services that would be cut if this bill were to pass. I want to take it a step back and remind you of the importance of specifically our public libraries in our rural communities. There are very few places anymore in our rural towns that you can be for free outside of your home, and the public library is one of them. In Redfield, dance is very popular, and we have people from out of town that come and bring their kids in to dance. Are they really going to turn around, go home, drive the 20 miles, and then turn around and come back? No. They're going to go to the library for free, even if they don't have a card. They might bring their children there, and they will partake in our free activities, our games, our materials, help with homework. Or the parent might just come and use the free Wi-Fi. It's a place, one of the only places they can go and be for free. We are vital community centers. which is why, yes, we still are buildings of books, but we're focusing on our programs, our free and low-cost programs that in small towns are often very hard to come by. One of our most popular programs, we have a lot, is summer reading. And summer reading is directly supported by the South Dakota State Library. They provide all the libraries in the state with a 350-page manual that they pay for. And they also provide free training for all the librarians. I am the only full-time librarian in my community. I have one assistant. So to try to come up with these programming ideas and these materials would take so much time away from our community. So instead, the South Dakota State Library pays for these materials, these copyrighted images, and these pamphlets, and trains us so that we can provide high-quality and high-quantity programs to our community. If you were to pass this bill, many of these things would go away, and our public libraries and our rural communities would be hurt. So I do urge you to oppose this bill.
Good morning, everyone. I am Natasha Nutledge, the Dolan Community Library Director. I'm representing myself. I just wanted to share with you the Dolan story, which Representative Greenfield knows very well. Our school had cut our library. The city in 2018 had 257 people who had visited the library for the whole year. And so I came upon, came in, filled the role as librarian, first as a volunteer, and then I ended up talking the school into hiring me and combining the city and the school library together to make a combo library. We were, in 2020, so close to being a reading room. We weren't following all the statutes. We didn't know what was offered, and the state library reached out to us. How can we help? What can we do? And they made a huge difference in letting us offer new services. They also educated me. I didn't have any library background, and so I went to institute for 4 years. I cannot stress enough how valuable the state library has been to our library. We would not be able to provide the services that we provide right now. And if they go, I'm not sure how we would go forward. We're credited now. In 2024, we had 6,208 people visit our library. So, I get kind of emotional because it's just such a wonderful story. If this bill is passed, what am I going to do? What are these small libraries? And we are the heart of your community. So thank you.
When the governor's budget came out on December 3rd, I'm sure, just like me, you were all kind of shocked with the cuts that happened. After that budget address, I go home and my email is just blowing up. My phone is blowing up. Text messages, you name it. There's at least 30 emails a day on this topic.
I just wanted to mention to Representative Wahlberg that I feel bad for you only getting emails from the librarians, because I had enough of these to wallpaper my whole living room. The recommendation will go to joint appropriations of do not pass. Thank you all for being here and for your testimony. I just want to mention also, in addition to what Representative Halverson said, I did receive a lot of letters as well. And the outpouring from the hearts of the little children were really, really special to me. That was wonderful.
That's House Education Committee testimony on House Bill 1041. The bill was forwarded to the Joint Committee on Appropriations with a do-not-pass recommendation, but it still has to go through the Joint Committee on Appropriations process. So funding for the state library is still at risk. You can find full coverage and unedited testimony online at SD.net. That's a service provided by SDPB. In the Moment, host Lori Walsh here with South Dakota Focus host Jackie Handry in SDPB Sioux Falls Studios. We have just shared our love for South Dakota, our love for books, our love for libraries, our love for SDPB, our love for each other.
Yes.
All of that has been packed in to 1 hour of In the Moment, and we're going to close the hour with a reminder that this is our Valentine's Day membership drive, where we share love with you and you share a little love with us. Jackie, what do you think? Going into the weekend with love for SDPB is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing at all, especially if for some of us a long weekend going into a three-day weekend, we get to get a little extra time to think about and reflect, especially in these wintry season. It's kind of nice to think about what are the things we love? What are the things we love in our community, in our state, about the content that we consume and what fills our days. And I'm so happy to be able to fill my day with what we produce here at SDPB. Yeah. I wake up in the morning and the first thing I do when I'm like attempting to enter consciousness is I roll over, I find the SDPB app on my phone, and I hit play. And I hear Crystal Mija, I hear news stories from Lee Strubinger and CJ Keene in Pierre, and it helps me center into what's happening today, what do I need to know before so much as a single drop of coffee has entered my body. I am ready to go because of what we do here at SDPB.
Crystal Mija, we love her so much. And again, she brings the news to me, but she also does it with this way that is a passion for South Dakota, a compassion for the stories that she can tell me the most difficult things that have happened. And I know that she cares, but I also know that she has control of the material and she's bringing the next news story to me. So I absolutely love listening to her and hearing those headlines from her. I look so forward to South Dakota Focus because you take me all over the state. And I'm mapping what I'm going to do this summer based on some of the tourism stories that you've done. Because you have found things that I didn't even know were out there. And I know a lot about the state of South Dakota. I love the In the Moment producers and the ideas that they bring to the show every day with their fresh, innovative thoughts. I loved going to Pierre and watching Lee Strubinger work and watching the engineer. I love watching you on the inauguration of Governor Larry Roden, you and Lee Strubinger and the Grand March. SDPB is there bringing you those local stories daily. We are here for you in the morning. We are here for you at night. I would be remiss without telling you how much I love Carl Gerke and Jazz Knightley.
We do love Carl.
This is so important to me, and that's why I am a sustaining member of this organization. I want you to be a sustaining member too. Call 605-443-6963. I always go online, sdpb.org. We have South Dakotans here answering those calls. They will walk you through it. If you have a problem with your membership, no question is too simple because I've asked them and they have walked me through with great patience. I say, oh, thanks for doing this. You're doing this because I'm, you know, your coworker. And they're like, no, Lori, this is what we do for South Dakotans every single day.
It's a beautiful thing. And I would be remiss if I didn't take a second to pump up my good friend Lori Walsh, because you are there with me on the drives to and from Pierre when I'm like, boy, I was busy working. I didn't catch the show. There it is in my podcast feed, and I get to catch up on your incredible arts interviews within the last week. I just have to tell you, no one does it better than SDPB's Lori Walsh, and I am so grateful to not only be your colleague, but also your friend and your galentine, and to pitch with you, as is tradition for this Valentine's membership drive.
I always ask for Jackie on Valentine's Day, and she so far always says yes. And also thank you to donors Milt and Chris Carter, who know the value of sustaining members and are daring all the listeners and viewers to a $50,000 sustainer challenge. So that means any sustaining action that you take, becoming a new sustaining member, increasing your sustainer membership, switching to the EFT checking account withdrawal for a sustaining membership, all of those will trigger this sustaining match. So thank you so much for them. This is going to be the moment where I say that's our show for today. We hope that it served you.
I love that line.
Now we get to open our chocolate.
Yes.
Here's the little wrapper.
A little ASMR.
From all of us here, thank you for listening.